there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so welcome back. Hope you haven't missed us too much these past 10 days or so. We've just come out of the Golden Week holiday here in Japan, which was great. Plenty of sleep, food, and drink here. Personally, I've probably put on a good few kilos. I've been avoiding the bathroom scale, so not so sure, but who cares? Anyway, back in the saddle now, and for today's episode, these are two back-to-back conversations, both on the topic of investment properties in Japan. The first one is with two partners from Canada, and we discuss the differences between investing here and there, cheapest entry points into the market in Japan, the life cycle of structures, both practically and from a tax depreciation perspective, how to submit an offer, how the actual purchase process works, how long everything takes, the need for structural inspections, the purchase costs themselves, and a bit about how we work and how much our services cost as well. So enjoy this first conversation, and I'll see you again on the other side. All right, go for it. So your email mentioned something about the cheaper end investments at the bottom price scale. I don't know if we can still get 25,000 US. I mean, yes, in some cities, but the ones that we'd recommend, if you had the budget, would probably be towards the upper range of that. 50, 60,000 is where they start to make for more interesting locations. The 25, 30,000 US is usually going to be bedroom communities, prefectural capitals, which are good for cash flow, but the tenant base and the capital growth potential is usually not as attractive as it would be in bigger cities.
Okay. For our end, I'll just explain where we're at. So right now, our timeline to begin this kind of a process would be looking at a year to 2 years.
Yep.
Again, we have our own changing real estate market to contend with here that will ultimately be what forms our investment capacity. Yeah. That's not necessarily a problem. So I was more interested on it because comparatively to Canada, the investment entry level is quite a lot lower. So I was curious as to what that entry level is really going to get you. I know that insofar as our profile is concerned, we're not so interested in building equity necessarily in the home. We understand it's not something that's as quickly growing as for example, the real estate here was over the past few years. We're really looking from it at it from a cash flow perspective.
Oh yeah, I was referring more to resale value, whether it'll stay as it is, fall off a cliff. Oh, there's Tommy now. Are you with us, Tommy? Oh yeah, there he is.
Hey, can you hear me?
Nice to meet you. Yep, we can.
Nice to meet you. Sorry for the delay.
Not a problem. We were just discussing bottom end of the market investment profile. Sorry, go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, so I was just saying that I think our primary concern would be more the point of cash flow. Our intent is not actually even to withdraw any profits we'd be making, but more to hold them for ultimately reinvesting and acquiring a larger portfolio as time went on. So the resale value, unless there was some kind of reason to have to sell quickly or to release the property, it wouldn't necessarily fall into what we're considering.
Not quickly, but I wouldn't hold them past a certain age, depending on whether you're going for houses, which are usually not going to be the best investment asset classes because they're really not built to last in Japan. So maintenance racks up severely. But even for concrete structures, or let's say wooden buildings that you own entirely yourself, like say those 2, 3, 4 multi-unit apartments, when they hit a certain age, which would be for concrete about 40 and for wooden structures about 30, is when maintenance expenses again start going up more rapidly and frequently. So you would want to cycle through them once they hit that age point. And at that time, we would like to at least try to get our capital back, not have it fall off a cliff, right?
That's definitely interesting, because it's a bit of a different scenario here. We have houses that are many hundreds of years old, so definitely it's not a perspective we automatically have, I would think.
I'm aware of it. That's why I'm saying, so we would recommend, if you're buying a wooden or steel frame wood structure, to make it up to 20 years on purchase. And if you're buying units in a co-owned condo block, what they call mansions here, up to 30 years on purchase, just to give you that at least 5, 6, 7 years of cash flow before you'll start considering reselling it.
Perfect. And so I've read through some of, I will admit, I haven't finished the ebooks just yet, although they're very interesting, so I just haven't had the time. Can you walk us through, for example, what the process would look like going through you specifically, for example, like what, as a foreign investor looking to have the money, let's just say we were ready to go today, what would the process look like?
So we can put in a couple of hours of just free research, and we're always happy to endlessly exchange emails and tell you what we think about particular properties and aspects of the market and so forth. Once you want us to put in more staff time, which means beyond those 2 hours of initial research, or contacting, submitting offers, conducting due diligence, just getting in touch with third parties, at that point we'll need to be engaged, which means 2 documents signed and witnessed to allow us to represent you here, and our fee estimate paid in advance based on the budget that you think you're going to be investing. We will be crediting or debiting post-settlement depending on the end price. And that's a fixed price for the entire purchase facilitation. So you're not going to have to pay us anything else, even if we end up looking at, you know, 10, 15, 20 properties, as is often the case. We would then be in Japan. A lot of the time you'll have to first submit an offer to get the full due diligence info, because some of the agents have to pay certain fees to owner unions in the case of condo blocks, or they have to retrieve documents for the seller, and they're not going to do that before they have a serious offer on the table. Now, the offers are not, I'm not sure about Canada, but unlike the US or Australia, the offers are not legally binding when you submit them. So you can submit an offer, and on it you note pending due diligence. Sorry, I've got a guest here. Pardon me. You can submit on the offer pending due diligence, for example, tenant information, building renovation history, status of reserve funds pool in case of a condo arrangement. And then the agent will start providing all of that information to us, and we can then either pull the offer back if it's unsatisfactory, or try to renegotiate the price. But we would ask that we don't submit multiple offers and then pull back the majority of them without any substantial reason that's anchored in due diligence, because that would burn our relationship with that agent. And it's hard enough to find the agents that will allow us to represent foreigners in a remote purchase, which most of them have never done before. So those relationships are really important to maintain. So again, we can pull back if there's any valid reason to it, which is anchored in due diligence. Otherwise, we ask that if you submit an offer, you'd be willing to go ahead with a purchase, assuming it all checks out.
I think on our end, that's normal, because we have a similar thing where we have the due diligence clauses to a degree and the financing clauses as well, but the offer is considered legally binding with the ability to withdraw. So our mindset is already going to be with that kind of a perspective.
That's good. Yeah. So here it's not a legal thing, but as many things in Japan, it's all very customs and manners oriented. So we do have to abide by that. And then it would normally, once the due diligence info is confirmed, the offer is accepted, and we're basically moving ahead, it would take 2 to 4 weeks to receive the contract and the appendix drafts from the realtor. at which point we'll review it. And if everything looks as it has been advertised, then we'll sign the contract and pay a 10% purchase deposit. And at that point, the judicial scrivener, which is the equivalent of a property lawyer here, will start preparing the ownership transfer documents, which again, you'll need to have signed and witnessed and posted back to us from overseas. So the entire process from the moment an offer is accepted until settlement is normally 2 months. In the case of older structures where you're purchasing the entire structure, again, we would advise to stick to 20 years and younger, in which case it won't be necessary. But if you are for any reason buying anything older, then we'd also recommend a structural inspection, which you'll have to pay for. It's normally between $500 to $1,500 or so, depending on the size of the property, the accessibility, the availability of inspection companies in that particular areas and so forth. So that if that does need to be done, that adds another 2 to 4 weeks to the process. So call it worst case 3 months with an inspection or 2 months without.
Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiya Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily. Ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties, Akiya Mart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akiya Mart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's A-K-I-Y-A-M-A-R-T, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today.
And I was seeing from the materials you had sent over that it's not common as it is here to do an actual property inspection from a general inspector for tenanted properties anyway.
A viewing is always, I mean, not always, some customers buy sight unseen, but a viewing is normally a part of the process if the property is not tenanted. If it is tenanted, then Japanese tenancy laws don't allow anyone to enter in any case. But if it's not tenanted, a viewing is definitely a part of it. An inspection would be a part of it if you wish to, but unless there are any severe weather damages, which the realtor and the seller would have to disclose as part of the due diligence process, if it's 20 years or younger, then it's probably not necessary. We're always happy to do it. It's always safer to do it, but probably not as necessary as for older structures.
Okay.
And it's definitely not as common here, yes. So a lot of people, especially if they're buying at the cheaper end of the market, they're pretty much assuming that they'll have to do some massive renovations. We would recommend it, especially for houses, because termite tracks, tilting, sinking, severe roof damages, these are all things that would cost a fair bit to repair if they can even be repaired at all. But a lot of people just buy it, you know, with the concept of at some point demolishing and rebuilding, so they're not too concerned about that.
Okay. And assuming we're buying, I want to phrase this the right way, but assuming that we were looking more towards tenanted type properties of that nature, coming into it, so in addition to the funds that you're kind of outlining here for the purchase, what kind of contingency fund would you recommend for things like repairs or closing costs, things like that?
So purchase costs, if you're using a proxy like ourselves, would be normally up to, depending on the price of the property, anywhere between 10 to 20%.
Okay.
I'll break that down in a minute, but if you're buying a small building, for example, it'll be closer to 10%, let's say something above 300,000 US. And if you're buying on the cheaper end of the market, let's say up to, let's say about 100,000 or less, then it's going to be closer to 20%. Our fee specifically does have minimums. So our minimum fee for condos or buildings is going to be 5% of 5 million yen. So even if you're buying something that's 20,000 yen, if you're buying something that's 20,000 yen, you'll still need to pay us our minimum, which is going to be 2,500. I'm just rounding it up as 100 yen per dollar. It's obviously a bit different now. If you're buying a house, which requires a lot more work and due diligence, then that's 5% of 10 million yen, so 5,000 US. So if you happen to buy something that's below these minimums, the fees could creep up to slightly over 20%. Let's call it 22 or 23, worst case. And the way that breaks down is the realtor fee is 3% plus 60,000 yen plus tax, which works out to be somewhere between 3.5% to 5.5%, depending on how cheap the property is. The legal and registration fees vary based on the official evaluation of the property, which is always going to be a little bit different to market price. So that can be anywhere between 1% to about 4%. And again, cheaper properties is a higher percentage, more expensive property is going to be towards the lower end of that. Purchase tax, which you get somewhere between 6 to 24 months after settlement, is going to be, again, varies depending on official valuation, but somewhere between 1.5% to 2.5% normally. And our fee, which is 3% to 5%, but with those minimums in place.
Okay. Perfect. In terms of the transfer of funds, I was seeing, again, from the material you sent over, that largely, or at least the impression I get, is that it would be done through the SWIFT system, and there would be a local bank of some kind that would be necessary, but that it would be difficult for us to open that. So what would be the process of getting the money into Japan, for example, for these transactions?
So for our non-resident clients, we act as your de facto bank account in Japan, because as you mentioned, you can't open a bank account here. You also need an address, a phone number. So this is all parts of the services package that we provide for purchase or management down the track. We would highly recommend that you don't let your bank convert your dollars into yens, because they'll always screw you over by somewhere between 3 to 5 yen to the dollar. We're partnered with OFX, which we use for larger transfers. I'm personally with Wise for smaller transfers. Those are usually, but there's a bunch of them out there. I think Revolut and a few others whose name I forget, Compass and so forth. So whichever Forex provider you use, just don't let your bank do the conversion. And the receiving bank, if you work with OFX, which is better for larger transfers, there's a receiving bank charge of somewhere between 2,500 yen for remittances under 5 million yen. So about 25 bucks for remittances under 50,000. And then something like 4,000 or 5,000 yen for remittances beyond that. But I mean, in the extent of a transfer that large, that's pretty minute. If you're using Wise, the fees are much smaller. There's no receiving bank charge on this end because it's a domestic transfer with Wise, but they're limited to remittances under 1 million yen. So if you're transferring the entire property purchase amount, it doesn't make sense to use them, in which case we'd recommend OFX again. And then we would receive your funds in bulk and distribute them to everyone involved in the purchase process. So the property lawyer, the seller, the agent, building management company, property management company, whoever's involved in the purchase and management, we'd be distributing domestically too.
Okay. And in the event we weren't purchasing for the full property in cash value, what would be the process of the financing? Would it be, again, through a proxy through you, if that's even an option?
That's not an option unless you set up a company. I mean, if you set up a corporate entity in Japan, there's one lender here who will let you borrow, but for strictly long-term lease investment properties. So you couldn't do Airbnb or get creative with it or anything of that sort. Mm-hmm. There's one in Singapore that does non-landed properties. So if you're just thinking about condo units, that could be an option. In both cases, you'll get 60 to 70% LTV and something like 3-3.5% interest, which is high compared to a Japanese national, but still better than what you get, I suppose.
Oh, yeah.
But they're pretty limited in their criteria. So they'll each have very specific locations, very specific property profiles, ages of building, and so forth. So if we're trying to go through one of those, we would have to first make sure that we're researching property that suit that criteria.
Okay.
And also, if you're going with a Japanese lender and you're setting up a company, because they'll the Singapore lender won't necessitate that you set up a Japanese entity, but the Japanese lender will. So if you're going with them, you need to factor in something like $3,000-$4,000 a year in annual corporate upkeep costs, so minimum corporate tax, accounting, bookkeeping, that sort of thing. That's going to be about $3,000-$4,000 a year. And also you would need a Japanese resident as representative director. That's a service that some accountants and lawyers can provide for about $500 a month. We can do it for about $200 a month, but that's still something to factor into your costs.
Sorry, I'm just taking a few notes here.
No, no, take it down.
I was actually wondering, in regarding the, excuse me, the privacy or the security, when it comes to transmission of documents, I mean, over the phone, it doesn't matter, but do you, are there any practices you have in place, or would it just be, it's just like the normal channels?
So most of the information you'll be receiving from our end, from the Japanese side, is going to be publicly available information. The only sensitive document would be the title deed itself, which we would never scan or email scans of. And that would be couriered directly with you with the rest of the property documents. But everything else is available via public registry. So there's not much concern on our end. If there's anything sensitive that you're remitting over, then, you know, we can have a discussion and password protect it and put it on a more secure cloud storage than we normally use. But otherwise, from the Japanese side, there's not much of that.
Okay, perfect.
Sorry, speaking of privacy, Tommy, I asked Ryan, but I didn't ask you. I'm recording the call for publishing on our channels, if that's okay with you. If not, let me know and I won't.
Yeah, no problem.
The next thing I mean, again, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole in any of these, so I'm just kind of looking for the moment at a at an overall examination of everything. In terms of the yield of these properties on average, the return, I saw it's anywhere between 5 and 9%. So in a dollar amount, assuming, for example, we were looking at a property at the mid to lower end to start, what kind of return could we look at?
The 5 to 9%, I'm assuming you're listening to very old podcast episodes.
That could be. That could be.
Because these days, if we get 6.5% net pre-tax, we're pretty happy. Okay. So, I mean, it can get lower if it's a higher end property, which will make the yield more stable, but lower. So I'd say they start at around 3.5-4%. But most of our customers, like yourselves, are usually not going to go out of their backyard for less than 4.5-5%. So call it 5 to 7 most of the time. And those would be available in most cities except Tokyo, Central Osaka, and Central Fukuoka. And Central Kyoto, which we very rarely see deals coming out of in any case. The rest of the locations would probably reach 6-6.5. If we go more suburban or secondary city, prefectural capital, and so forth. And buildings would be slightly higher, but then the structural maintenance is entirely on you. So you want to set, there's no reserve funds set aside for this purpose. So you want to factor in something like maybe 10% of the gross rental income to put aside for that.
Okay. And so let's just say, assuming a arbitrarily $300,000 purchase, what would the annual return in a dollar amount kind of look like to us? Assuming a standard property, just to give us an idea of like, again, we don't necessarily intend on withdrawing anything, but we want to know how long before it's possible to start reinvesting effectively.
So for 300,000 US, let me just quickly run that in yens. What is that at the moment? 45 million yen. So for that amount, we'd probably advise, I mean, you're the boss, obviously, we'll go with whatever you suggest, but we'd probably advise to try and aim for a small building, because that gives you, number one, a larger land plot, which is the only thing that could gain in value in Japan. And also, just there's no owner union, so you've got the creative freedom to experiment with various types of rentals. Down the track, maybe you know, repurpose the building into something else or completely demolish and rebuild. So if we're going for a small building, let's say 2-3 floor multi-unit, at about 45 million yen, you can expect, give me a second. So let's make it conservatively, taking into account maintenance expenses, vacancy expenses occasionally, and so forth. Maybe something like $15,000 a year, net pre-tax.
So I'm just writing it down. Okay.
Yeah. And we'll start with a higher percentage yield, but again, as time progresses and expenses rack up, we'll probably average down to about that, a bit more if we're lucky.
Perfect. I mean, again, it's from our perspective, it's refreshing because most properties here that we deal in ourselves in Montreal, from an investment standpoint, don't even cash flow. So most of our purchasers are relying completely on the building of equity over time and the property value itself, and they're taking hits of a couple of hundred dollars a month in terms of cash flow. So.
Yeah, but I mean, interesting, at least they have that equity, right? Here, that's very much unknown until we get lucky.
For the moment, I mean, here it's becoming unknown.
That,
I think.
Having said that, it's been really good in the last 12, 13 years in most major cities. But that's on the back of 2.5 decades of deflation and GDP growth. When the working force population is shrinking on an annual basis, is kind of a miracle. So I wouldn't count on it long term, unless you know some major policies come into effect, which I haven't seen much of. I mean, immigration policies are definitely improving under the new administration. Kishida-san is doing a good job with that. But the other part of it is the birth rate, right? So female workforce participation and the infrastructures for women to actually have a life and a career are still, I'm not seeing, I mean, the new cabinet is still all elderly penguins in black suits, not a single woman's face among them. So I don't see the birth rate improving. Maybe immigration will fix that a bit, but there's still some major issues. So we're not banking on any long-term capital growth. If it happens, it's icing on the cake.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in, fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
Right.
Well, as we're also, not jumping that also into means it. That rents can't be raised. That's another thing that's usually alien to people overseas. But rents, since we started, which is about 12 years now, rents have only remained stagnant or in some cases gone down if there's new developments built in the area, and it's kind of a race to the bottom with the older property owners. So do not expect to raise rents between tenants. The most we've been able to do is in super central location, maybe $20 a month or something.
Okay. Yeah, that expectation I didn't have, because I've seen from your other information that it's not something that happens there, which it is different from here, but it's an expectation that we already kind of had in mind. So again, for us, it's looking at we're looking at it more of a very long-term stability-based kind of an investment versus something to kind of deal in and out of quickly, yeah, on a short term.
Yep. Stability is what we've got in spades. That's good.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in terms of what I wanted to look at, that more or less covers it from the broad strokes, obviously. Tommy, did you have anything?
Other than the question I had, no, I was curious to know about your questions too.
We'll have a lot more to-ing and fro-ing once we're actually looking at potential properties for purchase. Then you'll see all of the nuances that go into the property selection. I'm sure you'll have a bunch more questions when we actually start looking at them.
I did have another question. So Tommy and I have the benefit of having connections with the Canadian Airlines here, and we can travel fairly cheaply in some cases. So our initial thought anyway was, when it comes closer to the time that we're ready to start moving on this, to perhaps come and physically visit. It did cross my eyes somewhere, I believe, that visiting the properties is not something, though, that would be beneficial.
It's beneficial in the sense of looking at an area and, you know, getting the feel of a particular location, and getting if you have a particular property in mind, a building or a structure, to look at the structure itself. But if the properties are tenanted, tenancy laws in Japan prohibit anyone from entering it, even when it's changing hands, even in between lease renewals. It's just never entered unless by tenant request. So you're not going to be able to physically enter the property, but a lot of our customers definitely come either before or after the purchase, just to suss out the environment. That's definitely a thing. And we do have people who come here. I'm actually going to see one on Monday. They have particular properties in mind. They do want a tenanted property, but they do want to physically visit the building in the neighborhood before they pull the trigger. So that's definitely doable.
Okay. So if we were planning, and for example, when it comes time in perhaps a year or two to come through, it would be still worth our time then with you to find a way to maybe meet up, visit these places if they're within a reasonable range from you, obviously. And take a look, or at least to have maybe even a video conference while visiting, so that we have the live interpretation from you while we do it.
Definitely, and we also do that in other locations. So obviously, perfect, Trip expenses would have to be paid for us, but we're happy to come and visit other cities as well. Doesn't have to be right in our backyard. Because we work with third parties, we work all over the country, so it's quite usual that we go to other places to do viewings. But with condo units, if you're buying a condo unit, really the due diligence is more a case of reviewing the documentation that the building management company and owner union provides. So we look at the reserve funds that they've collected over the years, how much they've got, what big renovations were done in the last 10 years, and try to assess whether there's a risk that building fees will jump very high very soon or not. So there's not a huge advantage to a viewing in a condo unit situation, but if you're buying anything else where you're going to be owning the structure, that's definitely a concern. That's definitely something we'll want to look at. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. It's not necessarily the longest meeting in the world, but I think that on my end, that covers what I wanted to look at this stage. I think we wanted to just have somebody explain to us the process, that it's not just us relying on what we're reading and our understanding of it. So I think it clears up a lot of what I think we already knew, but definitely puts it in perspective for us in terms of the timeline and the process.
Fantastic. Sure. So I'll just add on a totally different note. You've mentioned that you work in real estate, right?
Yes. Yeah, we're real estate brokers and property managers.
So we're always happy to, we provide 20% of our commission on any first sale for a customer that comes in through a referral. So don't be shy to send people our way if you want. They can be your guinea pigs too.
No, definitely. Well, I mean, over time, we'd like to kind of build more of a link. Again, I think it's just something that Tommy and I have discussed for years at this point now. And being within the industry, like I said at the beginning on the outset, we're always looking for ways to kind of capitalize on our own interests in a way. So if we can find a mutually beneficial arrangement, certainly we'll be happy for that.
Excellent. I look forward to hearing from you. Let me know when you're ready and we'll start moving forward on stuff.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Have a good night.
Take care.
You too. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Good informative chat there. Now, the second call is with a US national who's married to a Japanese national. They both live in the States, and he was wondering about his options to potentially get an investment loan here in Japan. So we talk about the differences between an investment loan and a home loan, how to potentially qualify for those in his particular situation, and then we go deeper into the actual property selection criteria. So we talk locations, yields, various cities around the country, and Fukuoka City specifically, what capital growth potential looks like in Japan and whether or not one should bank on it at all, exchange rates and how to lock them in ahead of a purchase, expenses, tax deductions again, and also about what type of property makes the most sense for various budget and investment goals. So again, a really good conversation on the topic of investment. Enjoy the chat, and I'll see you again one last time right after this.
Okay, cool. So I've scrolled down to your initial inquiry on the email there. So you mentioned, where are you? There you are. You were mentioning that you would like to buy a building in Japan, that your wife is Japanese, but you're currently living in California, and that you would you be able to get a loan in Japan with her as the director? So the director has to be a Japanese resident. I'm assuming that your wife is currently not registered as a resident here, right?
Yeah, not. Maybe they'll have to be her parents.
I'm not sure her parents would qualify for signing a loan at their age. That would be something to look into. Ooh,
I see.
Yeah, I mean, okay, another option would be to come visit Japan, re-register as a resident, and then kind of go back to the U.S. on an extended leave kind of thing while she's still registered as a resident.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure if she'd have to pay taxes in Japan or to re-register.
She would have to pay her pension and health insurance and some municipal taxes. So yes, that would come with a few expenses every year. But I mean, so would the corporate structure itself would come with about $3,000-$4,000 worth of annual expenses in minimum corporate tax and bookkeeping and accounting. So in the grand scheme of things, that's maybe not a huge extra amount to spend.
It's fine, you know, to pay like some extra as long as it's not too much. You know, I understand this like cost of doing business. It's fine.
Yeah, I'm not sure, to be honest. It's kind of a gray area, so I'm not sure if the lender somehow finds out that she's not physically here, does that compromise the loan terms? I really have no idea, and it's kind of a thing where you don't have anyone to ask because they'll just say no if you ask them, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So I do have the meeting with a bank, I think, in a couple of days. I figured like if we figure out some sort of questions that I can ask them, you know, I'll just send them a question. And
is it a U.S. bank that you're talking about?
No, it's here. So right now I'm in Nagasaki. My wife still has a bank account from way back when. But of course, she hasn't gotten any deposits in a while. So this is basically, at some point I was like, yeah, let's close the bank account. But now I'm like, let's keep it. Let's not close it.
That's not a bad idea. The first thing I would say is when you enter the bank, don't tell them that you're now residing in the States, because then they might automatically ask you to close the account and definitely will not be talking to you about loans.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah. Also, she hasn't worked maybe the last time. So I think maybe 5 years ago is when she stopped working, but she only worked for like 1 year. And then before that, I think she was away again from 3 years. And then she worked maybe 3 years before that. So maybe in total, she might have like 4 years, maybe five of work in Japan.
Well, investments, but like not recent. Investment loans, I'm assuming you're not inquiring about a home loan. You're inquiring about the investment loans, right?
Yeah.
So investment loans are assessed a bit differently. It's not necessarily a case of whether she would qualify based on her income, but whether the property would qualify based on the rental yield that it can command. But they would definitely take into account her personal circumstances and experience in real estate as well. So I wouldn't get my hopes too high, but it's an interesting conversation to have. Yeah.
Yeah. We do something similar in the US. Of course, my wife is not involved in any of the real estate stuff or any of the investments. It's mostly just me. But in here, you know, I'm thinking we might have to involve her because of the way the Japanese system works with getting loans, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean,
right, like it's easier.
The other option is the Japanese lender that we talk about in the podcast that you've listened to, the one that does non-resident loans, is Shinsei Investment and Finance, which is a subsidiary of Shinsei Bank. So they would require a Japanese resident as representative director of the company to approve the loan. So try to figure out what it would cost her in annual, again, pension and health insurance and municipal taxes. Because the other option is to appoint, I know that lawyers and accountants provide this service of appointing themselves as representative director for about $50,000 yen a month. We can provide that service for 20,000 yen a month. So if the total that she has to pay annually for, you know, maintaining her residency is higher than that, then that's another option.
Yeah. That's good to know these numbers. Let me ask you. So you're recording this. At some point, I'll be able to go back and reference this video.
Yes, I'm only going to be publishing. Yeah. I've got a backlog for publishing about 5-6 months at the moment, but I can just send you the raw recording at any time.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Thank you. Okay. So that's what I was saying. The first thing would be the loan, and then the second, I think, you know, I was in Fukuoka a couple of days ago, and it looks really nice. Like it's kind of like New York.
Let me know next time. We'll get together for coffee and stuff.
Yeah. Sure. Absolutely. I just didn't have too much time, you know, because I was thinking about that. Yeah. So, I mean, it looks like it's teeming with life. You know, it's awesome.
Definitely the best city I've ever lived in. But I'm kind of biased. I've been here for about 12 years.
Yeah, much longer than me. But yeah, that makes you kind of a bit of a, you know, specialist in that area, I guess.
We more familiar with it because we live here, but we don't rely on ourselves as the experts. The position that we're in is as acting proxies on behalf of foreign buyers. We work with professionals all over the country, so we would really, I mean, yes, we do have more on hands-on knowledge in Fukuoka, but we normally rely on realtors and other professionals in the area that are familiar with the city. So we're ambivalent to where in Japan we're purchasing. But yes, Fukuoka is a very good investment destination if you can live with a slightly lower yields.
Yeah, like I was watching some of the other videos, and I know going up north, like Sapporo, it's better, but then you have all the issues with the snow, and even though the yield is higher overall, you might not come out ahead, might be the same.
I'd say of the major cities, Fukuoka / Kobe / Yokohama are probably the best yields wise. But you would get higher yields if you go to prefectural capitals, bedroom communities. By bedroom communities, I mean places that are, say, within an hour, but convenient transport to a main city hub. Those would Saitama City, Chiba City, if you want to stay around Tokyo. Those are all good investment destinations as well. They maybe don't have the capital growth potential that Fukuoka has, but I mean, it's Japan. Whether capital growth happens or not is anyone's guess, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I think Fukuoka works really well because Nagasaki is close by. You know, you can take a train. It's, I don't know, it's like 1 hour, 2 hours. I forget how long it took us.
Well, I mean, that's attractive if you cater to short-term stayers and tourists and whatnot. Fukuoka is good just from a organic growth perspective. People are actually having babies here. The current mayor has done a really good job in turning it into a really white-collar professional services city, pushing all of the manufacturing and heavy industries out of the city to other cities in the prefecture. So it's got a good economic and tenant-based foundation, which is what we're looking for with long-term tenancies. If you are looking to cater to tourists, then yes, Fukuoka is good, but there are other locations that are good for that as well.
I see. I think, okay, so let's think about this a little bit. Where do you think are the highest yields right now? Because so in the US, we can get at least 10%. But of course, that's a different market than here. I don't know what Japan, what are the ranges here? Like 3 to 7?
So just so we're on the same page, when we're talking yields, we're usually referring to net before tax. So including all of your purchase costs and all of your known running costs, but not including annual taxes, which would differ depending on your personal circumstances, and also not including any unknowns like maintenance and vacancies and whatnot.
Now, if you've been following this podcast for a while, and in particular our JREP sessions, you're probably more than familiar with Blanca Kobayashi of Arc Reform. They're a bilingual renovation company serving clients in the Kanagawa and Kanto area, so Tokyo, Chiba, Saitama, Kawasaki, Yokohama. They can handle simple, small-scale projects as well as full house renovations, and they will work with you on the perfect design for your dream family home. But not only homes, Arc Reform also handle commercial property renovations, offices, restaurants, bars, shops, you name it, from traditional classics to the latest trends in interior design and renovations. So you want to email them for a free consultation and quote at info@arcreform.com. That's A-R-K reform, all one word, .com, and give your home or commercial space the love and care that it deserves.
So net pre-tax, I'd say 3 to 7%, with the caveat that most of our customers usually don't go for anything below 4.5-5% because they can get the same kind of yields at home. And to go beyond 6-6.5% would usually mean more, again, prefectural capitals, bedroom communities, third-tier cities, which is not necessarily bad. We're definitely going to choose the ones that have at least stable or growing populations, and there's still a bunch of those. But the tenant base is smaller, so vacancies could be longer. Over time, it will probably average out to not beyond 6-6.5 in any case. So that's probably the yields I would expect. Central Tokyo, all of Tokyo and central Osaka would normally be at most 4.5-5%.
That's good to know. It's kind of what I thought, really, from watching other videos. I guess the situation hasn't changed with the yields.
It's getting a bit more compressed, if anything, because property prices do continue to go up in most major cities, and rents definitely do not. So that gap is where you kind of lose your yield.
What do you think? So, because I don't know how Japan works compared to, say, North America. Like, if in the US, like, if the interest rates go up on a 10-year bond, which is used for like the major transactions, usually prices will come down. So I'm not sure which bonds, what maturity they use for, in Japan. It seems like they might try to do a little, they might loosen the yield curve control, right? Not cap it at whatever was really low, 0.25.
Yeah, Japan has been a bit more stagnant in that respect. So I don't really have much of a historical reference to refer to in this case. I know that fixed interest rates have slightly gone up for the first time in a long time, but it's nowhere near the volatility that you'll see in the States. So I don't really have a benchmark to compare it to, honestly. I can say that prices here tend to go up, obviously, when the economy takes giant leaps forward, but that hasn't happened much. It's more a case of international interest in the country that tends to bring prices up. And then all of the major locations that foreign investors are interested in start creeping upwards. But having said that, it's a lot more limited here to, number one, only the major cities. And even in the major cities, if you take Yokohama City, for example, which is Japan's second biggest city, the area around the 3-4 stations around the Bay Area have gone up, but the rest of the city is still very suburban and hasn't really changed that much in the last 10 years. So it's a bit harder to have any benchmark here. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I was just wondering. I'm trying to think ahead, you know, several scenarios, like what could happen, you know, in the future. Because I mean, I didn't expect Japan to try to, you know, increase interest rates either, but it seems that they might have to, because of things, you know, beyond their control, like everybody else increasing their rates. So life getting expensive for the Japanese. Look,
I'm no economist, but they definitely have to do something with that rapidly declining yen. I mean, it's bringing investment into the country, but it's very, very bad for exports, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's something. Like, it seems like
For imports, I meant. Sorry.
Yes. Exactly. It was like now is a good time to have your money here, but it's like, what do you do with it? It's like, what kind of, you know, business do you start? Like, that's how I'm thinking. It's like, oh yeah, the yen is so cheap. It's like, what kind of buildings can I buy?
But it's what, like, most of our customers have been doing, both on the real estate front, and I've also got another company that does other types of business investments for people. What they've been doing is firstly locking in the rates just because they're historically low at the moment. So they transfer funds over to Japan, and then they start at their own pace, they start looking at what to invest in. And I mean, worst case scenario, if rates swing the other way and you haven't found anything you want to invest in, you just, you know, send your money back home and make a profit on the exchange rate, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That's why I was really trying to do like a building, not an apartment. I think an apartment might be like too small for the type of money that I'm looking to deploy.
Yeah.
But then also, like, I am not used to doing it without loans. At least that's the way people do it in the US. So, so at least like a 50% loan, you know, for the investment loan. I think that's what you were saying. And in some other videos, like, I could get, you know, investment loan like 50%.
Well, if you're like talking 50%
down, the other 50%,
if you're talking about 50% of 70 million yen, that's 35-40 million yen. You can already buy a small building just with cash at that price level, right?
Oh, I did not know that. I thought like the smaller buildings came in at like 50 to 70 million.
No, they start at 35-40. We've definitely helped some customers buy at that price range as well.
But I am thinking those still closer to like the train stations and the subways, not like
we wouldn't advise on anything. It's just a matter of locate, like, for example, Chiba City, suburban Yokohama, even suburban Fukuoka, depending on how lucky we get, you can buy in at 35-40 million yen.
I see. So it's not that we couldn't do, like, you know, cash the whole thing. It's just, I'm not used to doing cash like the whole thing.
Yeah, no, I get it.
You know, that's the kind of juice up the yields.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's like, I can do some other things, you know, with that. Like invest in the US and get different yields.
Talk to your bank, like you've mentioned. And the other option, again, is that Shinsei loan, even if you don't end up, if your wife doesn't end up being a resident, that's also an option. But then you just have to factor in your annual costs and see if it's your while. I'd say for 70 million yen and upwards, it should definitely be worth your while. But, I mean, run the numbers and see for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. It would be very useful to get the link to that so I can get in touch with them. And probably then at some point I'll get in touch with the accountant one of the accountants that you keep mentioning, because I'm interested in the whole depreciation costs here. I don't know how they do it in Japan, so it might be good to have like a conversation with them. Well.
Yeah, it's a bit over my pay grade, but I do know that there are two methods which they can use, and they'll choose the appropriate one based on the age of the building and how much they can claim in its remaining years of depreciation. But how they actually do it is way over my pay grade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's what I was saying. I was just like, get in touch with them. So yeah, I guess my first thing is really the bank to see what I can get from them, and then we'll see if we can get something and then get in touch with the accountant, figure, you know, that part out. And then I guess we'll have to get in touch with you, see if we can find something.
Yeah, happy to.
Yeah. I think really that's all I have for now, unless you have something else to bring up.
No, we'll have a lot more toing and froing when we're actually looking at potential case properties and case studies. So I'm sure the conversation will continue, but the basics, I think you have covered pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Speak to you soon.
Bye.
Bye. All right, so that concludes our episode for today. Hope you found some value in these topics. And of course, if you've got other questions and topics of interest that you'd like us to cover here on the podcast, whether it's on investment or any other topic related to Japan's real estate market, don't be shy to send in your questions and let us know if you'd just like them answered on the podcast or if you would maybe be interested in being on the podcast as well. We would love to have you as a guest. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.